You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 457 of the Fabulous Peltoncast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Oh, you were the one who stumbled over it this time.
I wasn't sure whether I should say the.
Should you have worked in home of Cooper Kupp and the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks? We will get to that. Cooper Kupp's homecoming.
I do not know if Cooper Kupp moved to Renton, Washington already.
Well, you know, he's at least going to spend a lot of time.
Words matter.
At the practice facility. I was just including him within the Super Bowl 48, the Seattle Seahawks, not the Super Bowl 48 champions. He's part of a different Super Bowl champion, alas, one that isn't often
an asterisk.
Can you at least acknowledge Cooper Kupp's role in the Super Bowl?
Now I can.
We will talk about. I mean, I would have before. I had forgotten how good he was. We'll get to that later on in the podcast. We are starting this one with heavy hearts, a somber note, because of the passing of Sonics legend Slick Watts on Saturday at age 73. Slick had, you know, been dealing with round-the-clock care, regular care, since suffering a stroke in 2021. So, you know, is with Gus Williams a few weeks ago. Not something that really, you know, came is shocking news, but still tremendously disappointing given, you know, the role that Slick Watts played. You know, even for those, like, we never saw him play. He was traded by the Sonics in, I believe, early 1978, like well before either of us were born. But Slick Watts was just like around and part of Seattle basketball for basically our entire lifetimes, up to well through, you know, the time that I was working for the Sonics in Storm and actually got to interact with Slick a little bit and know him on a surface level. And, you know, even more so than his basketball career, which one of the things I highlighted when I posted about this on Blue Sky over the weekend is like people forget that Slick could play. Like he led the league in both assists and steals in the same season. Only five players in NBA history have done that. But much more so than Slick's playing career in Seattle, it's the role that he continued to play in the Seattle community for decades after his playing career, teaching PE in the Seattle School District, primarily at MLK Elementary in Rainier Valley, and then a fixture at Sonics games, and then Storm games as well. And
can you imagine if Slick Watts was your PE teacher?
I think the Garfield contingent of the listener did have a former NBA player as a PE teacher, not someone as notable as Slick Watts. But yeah, I don't know if the elementary schoolers really appreciated it. At least not in the sense of like what Slick Watts meant, but I'm sure he was amazing to have as a teacher, given his just enthusiasm for life and the way that sort of, you know, lit up every room that Slick came into throughout his life. And, you know, I'm sure that reflected on the kids as well. In thinking about Slick's playing career, I think Slick was sort of the first like beloved Seattle athlete, pro athlete.
Really?
Because the Sonics were the first team here. You know, when he started going, this was before the Seahawks came in 76, before the Mariners in 77. And like Lenny Wilkins was certainly a big deal here as a player, and it was an outrage when he got traded. But Slick Watts was sort of like the people's hero, I would say, to rise from an undrafted player who did not play Division I basketball at Xavier College of Louisiana, I believe. And because of the fact that his coach there, Bob Hopkins, joined Bill Russell, his cousin, on the Sonics coaching staff, that was the connection for Slick that got him in. He made the team, you know, in training camp, and then develops into one of the better guards in the league for a period of time. Sadly, you know, his Sonics career ended before kind of the team rose under Lenny Wilkins, his coach, to go to the finals back-to-back years and then win the 79 championship. But before that, Slick was maybe the most popular figure, I think, in Sonics history. Just the way that fans gravitated to him and the unique look that is so iconic, the signature look of the shaved head, the off-center headband that you could instantly recognize as Slick Watts. And then, you know, when you think about his legacy, remember the Sonics 40th anniversary team, the people he touched, you know, after his playing career. But then you have to include the song you heard at the start of this podcast is called Slick Watts. Lou Scholars chose to name this after Slick Watts and not any of the bigger Sonic stars who followed. I mean, that is a legacy right there. Like, Slick Watts, one of one in Seattle history, in Sonic's history, all of the above, I would say. So it just leaves a tremendous void. And you know, obviously, Slick hadn't been out there in the public in the same way since his stroke. So it's been a period of time, but still just a huge loss for the city of Seattle and for the Seattle basketball community. And, I mean, one of the things I was reflecting on in the past week, you know, the Seattle Times reported that on Saturday, when Slick passed, later in the day, Sonics, you know, former players and other members of the, you know, Sonics community were planning to gather to commemorate Gus Williams after he passed earlier this year. And one of the things that stood out to me is, like, obviously there are many reasons we need the Sonics back, and the sooner the better. But one of them is there's no organization to really remember these figures. I'm sure the Storm will have a lovely tribute for Slick and presumably for Gus Williams as well when their season begins in a couple of months here. But, like, the Sonics should be wearing patches, you know, to commemorate these players. There should be a moment of silence at their games and an opportunity to remember these people. And that's one of the things you lose when you don't have a team in Seattle.
Do you, on a personal level, you had a bit of a relationship with him as well. Do you have any personal stories about Slick Watts?
There's no stories necessarily. Like I said, it was just kind of, you know, the way that he always lit up the room. And as I posted on Blue Sky, the bizarre fact that I judged two Storm halftime dunk contests with Slick Watts sitting right next to him, someone who was an NBA player who led the league in assists and steals, and then me, was pretty hilarious in retrospect. But Slick was just awesome to hang out with and be around, and it was always a great time. So he, again, certainly will be missed and leaves a huge hole in Seattle sports. All right, well, let's talk about some happier news, starting with UW women's basketball heading to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2017. Is the first time that we are enjoying March Madness on either the men's or the women's sides at UW since 2019. And the selection committee spared us too much drama on the selection show. They were part of the second bracket that was revealed here. The second region that was revealed here is an 11 seed heading to the first four. Well, they will take on Columbia out of the Ivy League on Thursday at 4 p.m.
Yeah. So what do we know about Columbia?
Had to do a lot of research. I had paid a little attention to last year's Columbia team because they actually had a WNBA prospect on their roster in Abby Sue, who was drafted by the Connecticut Sun. And remarkably, despite losing her, she didn't play in the WNBA last year, but will be in training camp this year. Columbia was even better this year and is one of three teams from the Ivy League.
What?
In the NCAA tournament this year. There were two last year. They made it as an at-large. They're an at-large this year as well. They were the regular season champs of the Ivy at 13-1, the first time they have ever won the league outright. Beat Penn in the Ivy Madness semifinal, but then lost to Harvard in the final after splitting two regular season meetings with the Crimson. They swept Princeton, which was also an at-large selection. They lost in the semifinals. Besides those two Ivy teams, played four other tournament teams this year, going 1-3 with a win over Florida Gulf Coast and losses to Indiana and Richmond at neutral sites, and then a loss at Duke.
Honestly, maybe this is a good thing for our country that there's three Ivy League schools and is not Liberty in the women's NCAA tournament.
Liberty may also be in the women's tournament. I'm not sure on that one. It's their second consecutive appearance in the first four. They lost to Vanderbilt 72-68 last year in Blacksburg, Virginia, with Sue shooting 3 of 14 from the field in her final game. They do return three other starters from that team, five total players from last year's NCAA tournament team. And so they've got the experience advantage in the NCAA tournament. No
Liberty
UW players
in there.
They are.
Yeah.
I thought so. No UW players on the roster have ever appeared in an NCAA tournament game.
Wow.
So it's only Coach Tina Langley who has any NCAA tournament appearance, going with Rice in her final season there in 2019.
Has a UW team ever played in a play-in game?
I believe this is the first four appearance for UW.
I was trying to remember if the men did, but I know that they were in that territory a few times, but I don't think they ever were.
No, I mean, when they made it, they were either comfortably in, or when they were on the bubble, they were, you know, they were the comfortably in, or when they were on the bubble, they just didn't make it and didn't make the NIT either.
Yes. With the year that they played Marquette, I thought that they were an 11
seed. I guess they might have. Yeah, they were a 10 seed that year because New Mexico was a 2 seed that they beat. I'm very confident of that. So I can double check it, but I'm very confident that they were a 10 seed. I'm trying to remember. That was 2010. Oh no, they were an 11 seed. You're right. New Mexico was a 3. Okay. But no, they did not play in the first four in that situation. And so the men play the first four in Dayton, and then you go from there to your respective sites. In the women, they just play the game at the same location as you'll be playing one of these 16 sub-regionals. So in the Huskies' case, that's going to be in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where they'll be taking on Columbia. So a long road trip for the Huskies. Thankfully, I guess one of the upsides of being in the Big Ten, they have a lot of preparation this season traveling across the country and were remarkably successful on the road in Big Ten play.
So what is the expectation? Is there a point spread for this game versus Columbia right now?
Last I saw, Huskies were 1.5-point favorites. So Columbia, a pretty balanced team. They led the Ivy in offensive rating, finished second in defense. Their only real weakness is opponent effective field goal percentage. They allowed opponents to shoot 47% on twos. They have no active player on the roster taller than 6 foot, or no active player taller than 6 foot one, and ranked 318th nationally in blocks per game.
Wow.
So this is a game where Delaya Daniels, number one, needs to stay out of foul trouble, and number two, needs to eat in the paint against the smaller Columbia team. Because they have just nobody size-wise who can match up with her. It'll be interesting to see how the Huskies deployed Tyra Eke. You know, she started most of the year alongside Delaya Daniels, a pair of kind of traditional posts, and then about midway through conference play, coinciding ultimately with when the Huskies got hot down the stretch, they started going typically to smaller starting lineups, rotating a few players through that fifth spot, but usually putting a shooter out there instead of Eke in the starting lineup. It'll be interesting to see how they handle that one here. I think that's a question mark. Columbia is excellent at forcing turnovers and avoiding fouls. They also dominated the offensive glass, rebounding 43% of their missed shots, third best in the nation. So that's going to be an interesting one. Obviously, you know, a lot of that is against Ivy opponents that are much smaller than they're facing.
I was going to say, how are they able to do that with that kind of size? It's just not, they're not playing a Big Ten schedule.
They are not playing a Big Ten schedule, suffice it to say. But that's an interesting one. The Huskies are actually below average on the defensive glass. So I'm curious to see whether they can keep Columbia off the offensive glass. Sophomore Riley Weiss is the player to watch on offense. She was an all-Ivy pick, has averaged 17.8 points per game in first season as a starter, attempting 8.1 threes per game at a 37% clip. So got to find Riley Weiss behind the arc. On defense, you want to watch out for Kitty Henderson, the Ivy Defensive Player of the Year, after averaging 2.4 steals per game. And somehow she also led the offense team in offensive rebounding from the point guard spot at 2.6 per game. Basically, everybody but Weiss, their designated shooter, crashes the glass. So that's part of how they do it, is by committee. So, yeah, I think the Huskies are the favorite in this game. They are not an overwhelming favorite. Like, you know, Columbia was certainly a perfectly deserving choice here is an at-large, even if perhaps not quite as strong a resume as the Huskies. And basically it was inevitable that they were going to have to face an Ivy team because the first four, both games, include an Ivy team and they can't play each other.
I mean, many of the last teams who made it in the tournament are Ivy League teams, right?
Well,
it was Harvard who won the Ivy tournament and they're a 10 seed. and then Princeton and Columbia. I mean, they're kind of down there as the lowest.
Yeah, no, I think they might have been the two last teams in the field. I haven't checked what Nate Silver's model has, which I think is pretty good on the for the college tournament. Huskies are in Birmingham Regional 2, and they so that's interesting. So Nate Silver's model is the one that really accounts for travel, and that has Columbia as a slight favorite in this game.
Really? Okay.
I mean, it's 52-48, so it's a toss-up here, but that's probably one factor in why, even though the Huskies generally rate wet better by the advanced stats models, perhaps an explanation of why the point spread is generally a little bit lower than,
I'm
that
being
would
very
necessarily
triggered
imply.
by going to natesilver.net to the Silver Bulletin right now. 50-50, you say, Nate.
Oh
It's been a while since I've been here.
Oh dear. Oh
Complete
dear.
toss-up, huh?
Yeah, so that definitely is based on the travel because the Huskies are rated 39th overall. Columbia's rated 42nd, which is pretty close to where they are, I think, in most of the, the advanced metrics that I've seen, Bartorvik and the like.
Are all these public, by the way?
I know you love a Bartorvik.
Oh, Bart Torvik's my guy.
I'm not sure about that. So if the Huskies advance on Saturday, they will take on West Virginia. That game would be at, I mean, either way, the game, West Virginia will be playing at 11 a.m. on ESPN News. It's a brutal matchup. Is the number 6 seed. West Virginia is ranked 9th on Bartorvik, dramatically higher than the host and number 3 seed North Carolina, which is 21st. They are the lowest seeded team in the Bartorvik top 18. And the reason for that is they excelled at blowing out lesser foes, but were 3-5 in quad one games, with two of those 3 wins coming against Kansas State, which rated very well overall. They started 19-1, but then lost star center Ayoka Lee, who missed both of those matchups against West Virginia. The Mountaineers are it's Press Virginia, much like under Bob Huggins on the men's side, number one in the country in forcing turnovers. It's their third consecutive NCAA tournament appearance, the last two under Mark Kellogg, who has made the tournament 4 of the last 5 seasons, dating back to his time at Stephen F. Austin. Got his first win last year when they beat number 9 seed Princeton before losing to Iowa in round two. West Virginia is led by dynamic guard J.J. Quinterly, who's averaging 20.6 points, 3.0 steals, and was the Big 12 Defensive Player of the Year. So Huskies, if they advance, could face two conference defensive players of the year in as many games. And if the Huskies somehow get through all that, host North Carolina is making its 5th consecutive NCAA tournament appearance under longtime Ivy coach, fittingly, Courtney Bangert, has lost in the second round each of the last 2 years, UNC, after making the Sweet 16 in 2022. But this is the Heels' first time hosting since 2015. And obviously, that's a huge advantage on the women's side that just doesn't exist on the men's side to the same degree, where you can't play on your home court in the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of the structure is basically you have to win 2 games for the privilege of playing North Carolina and Chapel Hill. And it's just not going to happen, right? Like the chances of
I
both.
mean, I wouldn't say it's not going to happen. The Huskies
They're
have, I mean,
not going to beat North Carolina. Like the amount of
I think they're, I
things,
mean,
the percentage chances that
I'm,
have to happen, one, two, three,
I
to
don't want
get
to,
there.
yes, that's the real reason. But you could have said something similar about them getting into the Final Four in 2016, and they just, they had to win twice, had to win on a road site against, I believe that was Maryland that year, just to get to the Sweet 16. And then, had to beat Stanford to get to the Final Four. Like, it was a pretty unlikely series of events. So I'm not going to rule it out, especially because the Huskies have shown the ability to be competitive with the best teams in the country. But yeah, it's certainly a long shot given everything that's going against them. I
I mean,
think that's.
if you wanted to view it a little bit rosier, West Virginia is probably way underseeded per Bartorvik. North Carolina is a little bit overseeded.
Correct.
So, if those two things even out to two teams that are appropriately seeded, if both teams probably should be 3 or 4 seeds, something like that. I mean, I guess if they're 21st in Bartorvik, they should be like a 5 seed, right? North Carolina. Or I guess a
Yeah,
6 seed,
six.
right?
Yeah.
So, if you're viewing it that way, then, but is still the home court advantage matters so much. And UW is having to travel so much farther than all three of these teams. Obviously, North Carolina not traveling at all.
Amusingly, if it does turn up to be an upset, If North Carolina gets knocked off in the opening round, you know who they're playing.
Who's that?
Oregon State.
Hello.
Could be a Pac-12 reunion. Oregon State in is a 14 seed
Did
after
they win the West
winning
Coast
the
Conference?
inaugural WCC tournament.
There we go.
Yeah, they needed to. Like they were
I mean, if
not a
they're a
strong team over the
14
course of
seed,
the
for
season.
sure. It's still a little strange seeing that. Like, even looking at the West Coast Conference, the men's talking about last, like looking at teams that had beaten Gonzaga, and I'm just like, it's so strange to see these teams in here. It doesn't quite sit right. All of the teams that are in the Big Ten make sense to me, but those teams being in the West Coast Conference doesn't quite work.
With the start of the NCAA tournament, be sure to join our tournament challenge groups on ESPN. We have one there for both the men and the women under the PeltonCast, as always. We'll have to figure out what sort of prize we might offer the winners of those two, but at the very least, a chance to compete against the listener as well as this host. So be sure to sign up for that before the action gets going for the men on Thursday and the women on Friday.
Do you think that the women's tournament is seeded a little bit more confusingly than the men's tournament
Oh, 100%.
statistically?
Yeah.
Like, is it because
They have not been shamed into it the same way that the men's committee has.
the men's committee has been shamed into basically using stats to
Yes.
influence and KenPom, obviously, to
And it's also
influence
the just
how they're
like,
seeding?
and this is, a large theme in men in women's sports, like the data has been so much more readily available on the men's side than the women's side. Now there's a lot more data on the women's side. Her HoopStats has been operating for a number of years. Sports Reference getting into the women's side of things, and then Bartorvik adding an equivalent. But I still don't see, even though wins above bubble is a concept, you don't necessarily hear people talking about Bartorvik.com on the men's side. So you don't necessarily have to dig as deep as you do still on the women's side, I would say.
The one thing that offends me about both of these is there's one team that is massively overseeded in both tournaments.
Oh, Oregon.
The team from down south. A five seed, 38 in BartTorvik.com, and a five seed. Are
Oh,
you
yeah.
kidding me?
Oregon is very ripe for an upset, I would say. Unfortunately, it's against Liberty. But on the women's side, I don't think they're overseeded. They're a 10. If the Huskies, the
UW's
Huskies,
better. UW is better.
I don't think that the I don't think UW is better. But I definitely don't think UW has a better resume. Now, had UW lost by one in Eugene, it was Deja Kelly made a shot at the end of that game. If UW had won that one game, I think they would be the 10 seed and Oregon would be the 11 seed playing in the first four. So those are the margins. Those are the margins. But
It probably doesn't matter for anybody. It's a thing to be angry about for like 3 days.
I mean, it's just exciting to have the UW women in the tournament, to have a UW basketball team as part of March Madness. We've been shut out of this for so long. So again, Thursday at 4 p.m.
Possibly some extra basketball too.
That is the upside of the first four and additional revenue units since those wins count.
Additional revenue units. Cool.
It's not as exciting to you as that sweet, sweet team control.
No. You know how I love that team control.
Oh, I gotta have that team control.
Wow. Additional revenue units for the University of Washington? They're really strapped for cash.
The athletic department is not doing that well financially, I wouldn't say, but
They are doing that well financially.
the athletic department is spending a lot of money. I'll put it that way.
I am here to say they are doing that well financially. Everybody's doing that well financially. And most importantly, the athletic department mostly is doing that well financially, more than anybody else. Have we had I don't are we going to talk men's Husky men's bass? I haven't even opened the notes.
Yes.
Okay.
I want to have a referendum on this, not a referendum, but I want to have a discussion about the season because we just ignored them because we had so much else to talk about last week. But now I
Yeah,
want to
because we
stick.
had so much else to talk about.
What do you mean?
We definitely wanted to talk about them,
Oh,
but we just
yeah.
had too many other things
No,
to get to.
I do have some thoughts. But we're going to stick with happier UW news as we round out our toast with a congrats to UW's twin pole vaulters, Amanda and Hannah Moll, who finished first and second in the NCAA championships in Virginia Beach. Both jumped 15 feet 5 inches, but Amanda won by virtue of needing fewer attempts
Is
to
this a
clear the
new
bar at
thing
that
that we're
height.
toasting to, or did you forget that we've already done this toast?
No, that was the Big Ten Championships.
Okay. This is the
This is the NCAA Championships. This is the real official. Now Amanda Mole is the NCAA champion. She had the NCAA record. Now she's the champion. Didn't set a single NCAA record in
What?
this meet. So, a bit of a disappointment from that standpoint,
Does
but
she
we'll
already
have
have
to.
the NCAA record?
Correct. But she
Okay, so
had
she didn't break
previously
her
set it
own.
twice this year. So,
Can't all be winners.
women's track, but still, the two best pole vaulters in the country, excluding nobody, are twin sisters from Olympia. It's kind
There
of
we
wild.
go.
Women's track finished fourth overall in the NCAA indoor championships. So again, it's just we're a fast school. What can you say? Some schools down south just aren't as fast.
Fast at paying off some committees.
I don't think the debate went on. That was a case where the advanced stats did not get taken into account. All right, should we talk about the Seattle Mariners?
Oh, absolutely, we should.
We are a
Next week,
week away
hot
from.
takes will return next week.
Is it now a tradition that for opening day you have to declare no holes every season?
I do
Although
not, only if I look around and see no holes.
I guess in 2000, it didn't end well in 2023 when you declared no holes. So maybe you shouldn't do that. Maybe that shouldn't be the
I
tradition.
think this opening day lineup is going to look a lot better than that opening day lineup.
I think it's going to look somewhat better. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say a lot better. It was more than no holes in particular because there were many good hitters in that lineup.
No holes. There was one Tommy LaStella-sized hole in that
Unfortunately.
lineup. Life came at you fast when you realized Tommy LaStella was DHing for the team. But Randy Arozarena now, like,
I'm
I
excited for a
think
full season
people
of
are
it.
forgetting that Randy Arozarena is on the team.
I think people are forgetting that Julio Rodriguez is going to bounce back.
Hello.
But that's for next week. For now, some news. Logan Gilbert has been named the opening night starter in
It
place
is,
of
yeah,
Luis
it's a little
Castillo.
bit difficult. Like Logan Gilbert, I think, has been anointed as the best Mariners starter. I'm not sure if that's statistically the case. I think Brian Wu might have been the best starter on the team last year, statistically.
On a per inning basis, without question, it was
But
Brian
didn't
Woo.
have the same amount of innings as anybody else. I was looking at, I think there's like maybe it was MLB The Show rankings of top starting pitchers. And I was like, Logan Gilbert's the one, which I think is fine. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with it. But if you look at those five starters this season, we could end the season with any order of
Wow.
them.
Do you know who had the most WAR among Mariners starters last season, according to Baseball Reference? The B
Was it
WAR.
Bryce Miller?
It was Bryce Miller.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
Luis
it is.
Castillo was fifth out of five.
But I think there's a chance that Castillo is still, like, if you ask me who the best starter is in the Mariners, ignoring stats and everything, just from watching them pitch. I think George Kirby is the best starter. I think George Kirby is the best pitcher on the Mariners. And I think Castillo might be number two. So it's a little bit difficult to rank them, but Logan Gilbert also, they're all so good that it's kind of, it's moot to really debate it. But seeing that Logan Gilbert has kind of been anointed as number one starter on the Mariners, he's obviously earned it. He was an all-star last year, had a great season, but it's going to be very fascinating. I think that's the fun thing about it is like, as we're progressing in days, they don't have a day off until I think the following Thursday, I want to say. I hate when they do MLB opening day and then there's like an off day the next day and it's like, I want to be in it. You give me baseball, I want to be in baseball. I need this every day, right? So I like that it's a while before there's an off day. And just seeing every single day of obviously George Kirby being on the injured list, but having a new starter that we haven't seen since last year starting, it just makes every game exciting to watch. So I'm so freaking ready for it.
So the Mariners this season, obviously they're still playing for that World Series, elusive World Series, but there is a chance for them to bring home some hardware this year because they announced that the Vetter Cup will be awarded this year to the winner of the annual Mariners Padres series designed by Eddie Vedder, honoring his ties to both San Diego and Seattle, something that started Padres fans and writers started doing this first, and then Mariners fans and writers picked up on it, and now it is an official. We have not seen the cup yet, so we don't know for sure if it's a cup. That is, the Pelton cast is withholding judgment on whether it's a cup until we see it. But also joining the Padres in support of the Epidermolysis Bullosa EB Research Partnership, a charity co-founded by Eddie and Jill Vedder, dedicated to funding research to discover treatments and cures for EB. So this is for a good cause. And like, this is one of those fun things that kind of sprung up. And I love that the organizations have now fully embraced this. I mean, you felt the rivalry when we were at that Mariners Padres game in 2 years ago,
I'm
didn't you?
trying really hard to not be annoyed about this.
Why?
First off, Eddie Vedder is a Cubs fan. Number one,
That is accurate.
I've been to the Pearl Jam facility in South Seattle. It is all Cubs out. There
No,
is
no
like
one is
Mariners stuff.
arguing that Eddie Vedder is a Mariners or Padres fan.
It's just a Vedder Cup.
He didn't name it the Vedder Cup.
I
Other
mean,
people did.
obviously he's participating. Eddie Vedder is happy that this is happening.
Of course.
So it is fine. I'm gonna come around and
If you
just say
want to.
I think it is better to have more fun things in baseball than not have more fun things in baseball.
If you want to argue that they should include the Cubs in this somehow, that's fine. Although, like, this is the joke of it is, of course, because the Mariners and Padres were designated as rivals when interleague play first started and automatically scheduled against each other. And their rivalry consisted merely of sharing spring training facilities in Peoria,
Ooh, I
Arizona.
hate those Padres.
But much like the hated San Diego Wave,
Yeah.
if you talk about a rivalry enough, maybe you could create one.
Anyway, I'm gonna be fine with it. I'm gonna not complain about it. I was on the Discord. I was like, I want to complain about this, but it's fine. We could just live a happy life. I don't have to complain about the Eddie Vedder Cup, the Vedder Cup. It's an okay thing to have happen. For now.
Rowdy
And
Tellez.
it's for a good cause.
Exactly. Seattle Times reported earlier this week that Rowdy Tellez can ask the Mariners on Sunday whether he's on the Major League roster, and they have 24 hours to tell him.
Love this. This is what I'm for. I don't care about your Vedder Cup. A player being, first off, he could ask the team anytime he wants, but
It's true, but it is in the contract that they have to answer him. Yeah, I guess they can ask is probably the strange part of it. Like it's unlikely he would decline to ask. He's gonna ask, and I think of it as
Rowdy
like,
Tellez will ask the Mariners on Sunday.
it's like, middle school and you're passing notes. Do you want me on the roster? Circle yet one, yes, no.
And then they have 24 hours. Start the clock, Rowdy. He just walks into the office, has a timer that has 24 hours on it, puts it on Jerry Depoto's desk, and it's like, the clock starts now, Depoto. You have 24 hours to make up your mind on me, Rowdy Tellez.
This is
Rowdy
somehow the
Tellez,
plot of an action movie.
I'm for it. Rowdy Tellez is what I'm talking about. Like that is baseball right there. I've always liked Rowdy Tellez. Even finding out that he's like a fun person, enjoyable to be around, even better, top notch. I'm really hoping he makes the roster.
So if not, he can opt for his release instead of going to the minor leagues with the Mariners. He's got some other opt-out dates in his contract. This is pretty
24
standard.
hours on all of them.
The 24-hour thing is a fun twist and wrinkle that definitely should have been made into a Mariners commercial.
I got it. It's the Mariners are so good at so many things. And honestly, like I don't even want to say not baseball in there because even like I was reading the Reddit page. I know I've complained about this already, so I don't need to complain about the people complaining again. But like the Mariners value menu on Reddit, I'm just like every single comment is like about how little the team spends on players, and I'm like, can we just be happy about this? Did we talk about the value menu last week? We didn't,
We
did
did
we?
not talk about the value menu. No.
They crushed it on the value menu. And they do every year. I know that it's gone up, but like this is one of the better things the Mariners do.
Yes, and many teams do this, not just the
Do they?
Mariners,
Because
but
okay, because I want to see. I was looking around for
it's
other
not
because I was like,
everyone.
do
But
the Cincinnati Reds have a value menu? And they
I
and
can't
you're
speak to that. But the Suns, notably in the NBA, announced this. They did this midseason.
did
Another
they?
team that you can't complain about. about the Suns spending. They are spending a lot of money. Maybe not spending
I think
well. They
maybe
are
they
spending
did this midseason
a lot of
for
money.
Other reasons. I'm
yeah,
telling you,
I
it's
think
just
so
the
too.
worst. I think Kevin Durant's entire career is a little bit tainted because of his tenure on the Suns. Like,
Cool.
I
We're not
find
going to
it
remember that when he signs with the expansion Sonics.
I don't even want Kevin Durant. That's a
Oh,
take right
wow.
there. First off, you said there's not going to be an expansion Sonics. Second off, I think Kevin Durant's career, I hate that, like, I actually sort of agree with the hot take people on it. It's just kind of a, like, an unfulfilling career that Kevin Durant has had.
I agree that in many ways it is unfulfilling. I don't want to have the Kevin Durant discussion right here, right now. What I will say is, I think people are holding the end of Kevin Durant's career against him too much, in a way that, like, he ruptured his Achilles, man. Like, we shouldn't expect him to be the best player on a championship
That's
team anymore.
fine.
He's 37.
He's also just seems like all of his quirks at first were like, it's fun. He only cares about basketball. He like tweets, and it's like, he's kind of an asshole too. I'm just like, dog, like, you're a basketball player. Have fun. Be a little bit more like Rowdy Tellez right now.
Shouldn't we all be a little more
We're
Rowdy
all
Tellez?
Striving to be more like Rowdy. They should have a Rowdy Tellez cup instead of Eddie Vedder. That's what I want. Mariners Brewers. That's a rivalry. It's a more obvious rivalry than the Padres. They stole our team. Stole our team, and we're still
rival.
Mad.
But they
still
did not
mad.
Designate us interleague rivals, because back then you didn't play the NL Central when they first started interleague. It was only the NL West. So you had it was like giant. It's like what Giants A's. It's Dodgers Angels, which
Yes.
Giants A's is going to be weird now. Not this year, but when they if they ever make it to Vegas, Dodgers Angels. Who else? I guess they probably had to stick one of the NL West teams with an AL Central team before the Astros moved into the AL West, right?
Could have been us. Well, an NLS team with an AL Central team, you're
Yeah,
saying.
because there was only
So it's
four AL
the
West
Astros
teams back
and the.
then. But it was the, I don't know who the Rangers naturally probably, was it the Astros? No, I guess it had to be someone in the NL West. Maybe Diamondbacks? Rockies? Yeah, I don't know. The natural
Designating
rivals.
a single rival is a stupid thing.
The Big Ten did it well, where they like determine some teams are rivals, but not you don't have to have the same number of rivalries for every team.
Yeah.
Which was a good call. Anyways, the value menu is good. And that does lead us into our next bit of Mariners news, our last bit of Mariners news, which is that J. Kenji Lopez Alt teased on Instagram that he is bringing teriyaki chicken to T-Mobile Park this season. So I'm very curious to see how
I'm
and what
fascinated
and
by
where
it.
this is going to entail.
I'm just going to say, I understand this is a good thing, but this is not even a criticism of Kenji Lopez Alt. Like,
I hope it isn't.
But like, why are you doing it at T-Mobile Park? Is he making teriyaki anywhere else in the city?
I think the idea here is that there's already a lot of good teriyaki elsewhere in the city, but there's not teriyaki at T-Mobile Park.
But like, okay, the price point on the teriyaki, it's not on the value menu. It's going to be probably quite high, right?
Probably, yes.
The point of teriyaki, we did a whole search for it. And what we concluded, first off, the prices of teriyaki are probably more than they should be now. That's fine. But like, the point of teriyaki is that your neighborhood spot is the best teriyaki. And I'm not sure if a thing like gourmet teriyaki, it's almost an oxymoron, happening at T-Mobile Park.
I don't know that it's going to be gourmet teriyaki necessarily. It's just like
but
the
like,
price point is what it
care?
Is because it's a ballpark. Everything is more expensive.
Why do we care that Lopez Alt is making it if it's teriyaki? Because the person that we want to be making teriyaki is Toshi, and we want to have it in our neighborhood. I don't know. There's just something about it where it's like, yes, teriyaki is good. Teriyaki at the ballpark is not necessarily good for $18 or something.
Well, I'm pro.
I'm going to be eating a value hot dog. I'm just going to be having one of those pickles.
You know how I feel about that.
Yeah, we will not be finding you eating one of those.
Under no circumstances.
I was hyped on it, though. An $8 draft beer, like an $8 high-quality draft beer with inflation, to me back in the day, like base, like pint price, right? This is like friggin' 2000, like 10 area, right? Let's say 2008 to like 2016, something like that. I'm like, $5 should be about the base price for draft beer. And that number kept ticking. This is at a bar, not the stadium. At any bar, I'm like, $5, that makes sense. Like PBR Rainier, maybe that's like a little bit less. And inflation kept pushing that price up. If all the nerds started liking beer, the prices got higher, right? And now $8 is like base price at, I would assume, many bars right now.
Right.
For draft beer. So to be able to do that at the ballpark is incredible. And the other thing about it is the Mariners value menu, it's not like it's just one cart, right? It is spread at multiple places. I don't, there's something like 10, 12 locations throughout the stadium. So basically wherever you're sitting, there is a place with it right there. And for me, like the fact that they have it built in right next to the kids' play area in center field, whatever, the clubhouse or where the moose is.
Is this the patio at 195?
Probably is what that is, I'd guess, yeah. So the fact that they have the value menu right there next to where kids spend a lot of time, they are doing the exact opposite of gouging people. It is kind of the least Mariners thing you could do because they're like, there are a lot of kids here. Let's have a value menu right at it. I'm appreciative of it. Obviously, prices could always be cheaper, but all things considered, what they could do is be like, there are going to be a lot of parents here that are buying shit. Let's have a bunch of expensive stuff right here. You know?
Right.
So I'm for it. That's the Mariners doing capitalism right in this one scenario. But that's what I'm saying also is like, there's so many things to not complain about. The other thing is the team is like number six in almost every projection system. Are people going to be mad? I mean, they're like a top 10 team by basically every projection system, right?
I don't know. I mean, they're also like a 50-50 proposition to make the playoffs. I mean, I guess that's just like, you know, how not that many teams are more likely than that.
Yeah.
All right.
I feel like 50-50 preseason is spring training is still fairly good in baseball.
Yeah, I guess the AL East does not project nearly as strong as I did for, I'm looking at the Pecota projections. The Mariners have the sixth best projection in the AL, but it's like basically, it's like basically the same as Minnesota.
Are people going to be mad when the team is good now?
I don't think so. No, if the team is good, they will not be mad now.
Oh, there's no if, no holes. No.
Oh Jesus, save it for next week.
It's really, I've set myself up. This, I feel like this is the first time period that I've been like a Mariners fan since the 90s, and I have really set myself up for just to be crushed by the season.
I am not planning to get crushed by this season.
I'm just like, they've got Eric Bedard now. They can't lose.
They do have the third best playoff odds at Fangraphs. Again, it's a very narrow.
Third best in the AL?
In the AL, or in the AL. Yeah. So.
I'm
yeah,
just saying, I don't think there are that many teams who would have the third best playoff odds in the AL, right? So who's ahead of them? Are they the best in the AL West?
No, Texas is like a hair ahead of them.
That's Texas and Baltimore?
Or Texas, all the Yankees, teams? And the Red Sox.
Really?
Yeah. So no, I'm sorry. They're just ahead of the Red Sox. Texas and the Yankees are the two ahead of them. They're third. And then they're in the same ballpark as the Red Sox and the Twins.
So the Fangraphs doesn't like the Orioles at all.
People are upset about the Orioles offseason, I think.
I think people are probably upset about every team's offseason except for the Mets and the Dodgers.
Perhaps.
Maybe the Red Sox. Anyway, I don't think there are that many teams who have that kind of projection, who are third in the AL per Fangraphs, whose fan base is so angry. And I get it. It's part of being a Mariners fan. But I do think that maybe people like complaining about the team more than they care about the team. Aileen was like, do you think these are people who don't, when I was talking at this, I was complaining at the complainers. And she was
just
like,
do this around the house.
She was like, do you think, well, I was talking at the value menu. I was like, it's good. She was like, "Do you think those people don't actually pay attention to the team?" And I was like, "No, I think they will watch 162 games and complain every single one of them."
I think it's fair to say that the Mariners have developed a certain cynicism in their fan base, a hard-earned cynicism. So I can't blame people for feeling that. I can only blame them for putting it entirely on the offense and not looking at advanced stats that say that the pitching is overrated. All right, let's
But
get into the
do you want to
roundup.
hear the harsh truth, or do you want to go win the Vetter Cup?
Okay, there we go. Let's get into the roundup, starting with the Kraken. Break them up. They now have points in four consecutive games over the past week with three wins in that span. Encouraging to see young players at the center of Tuesday's win in Chicago. Matty Beniers and Chain Wright combined for three goals and an assist in their 6-2 win over the Blackhawks. News not so good for the Seattle Sounders. No surprise, Paul Ariola officially out for the season due to an ACL tear in his left knee. Wish him well in his recovery and, hopefully getting back on the pitch in time for the 2026 season. Good news is at least, this is early enough that it shouldn't linger into 2026. But, he was off to a terrific start alongside Jesus Ferreira. And a key offseason addition, and now unfortunately that's over for this season. Jordan Morris is expected to miss 4 to 6 weeks with a hamstring strain that he also suffered in that loss at Cruz Azul, and then Pedro de la Vega expected to miss 3 to 5 weeks with a quadricep strain that prevented him from traveling. So, another in a series of muscle injuries for de la Vega since the Sounders acquired him as a designated player. And then on top of them, they also played without Brian Schmetzer.
Schmetz is out.
He was out due to illness, and Yimer Gomez Andrade for personal reasons Saturday at St. Louis SC. Both of them are expected back this week, but without them, the Sounders managed just one shot on goal.
I love that you included Schmetz as without them, they managed one shot on goal, as if I don't know who was coaching instead, was just like, I don't know, don't shoot at the goal.
Schmetz is a comforting presence on
Schmetz
the
was
sideline.
like, we're gonna shoot it at the goal this game. But the other coach was like, I don't know, pass the ball around. Have some fun out there. Like,
Orange slices at halftime. St. Louis got the game's lone goal in the 15th minute off a free kick.
this is
Sounders,
it. This is the Sounders. This is the fall season. We
this is
can
the
feel
reason
it.
for optimism about the Mariners.
I mean, you could see it happening in real time right now. Like, the record isn't good at this point. The fan base is not strong right now. Their players are
You think
dropping
that
like
people are
flies.
disgruntled about the Mariners? People are way angrier at the Sounders, I feel like.
I mean, there's not enough fans for it to register in the same way for the Mariners, but like,
Correct. And also, but it's more preposterous given that, they went to the Western Conference Final literally last season.
the Sounders?
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a spoiled fan base. Look, they've needed this for a while. But this is it. And I will be very fascinated to see what happens with Schmetz after this season. I mean, we'll see how it goes.
I
Obviously,
would
it's
tell you it's a
very, very
long
early.
season.
Yes.
It's a long
The
season.
Paul Ariola injury is, it's a long season, but he's not going to be there
I
for
think it
it.
takes out a lot of the upside of you were hoping that this team would be better than they were last year. But again, without him last year, they did make the Western Conference final. So they can be just fine. They will this weekend against Houston be without Nuhu and Obed Vargas, who are both on international duty. Dynamo should be less affected by international duty, so that's not great news coming into this home matchup. But so it would be very good for the Sounders to take at least a point in this one.
I mean, that was the thing that I noticed being at the match a couple of weeks ago, was the stadium was way less full than I feel like I've ever seen it before.
I mean, the
And I know
midweek matches tend to do worse. Early
they're,
season matches tend to do worse. So, a lot of factors were working against that.
I get it, but I've been to a lot of Sounders matches, and it was number one, the lowest, the smallest fan base that I've seen. And it did feel a little bit like, yes, the fan base, I guess, is angry. I didn't, that's not a
I mean, I
thing
don't
that's
think
going to
they're
register
like
with me.
angry during games necessarily, it's more outside of
But
games.
there's some disgruntledness around the Sounders. But that was the one thing where I was like, oh, things aren't going great here. overall, even though the team played fairly well and it seemed like the offseason was good. But I was kind of thinking about your argument about how people judge the trend too much.
Yes.
And don't judge the overall number enough. And I was thinking about that with regards to the Sounders, where it's like people are so mad at the Mariners and they will sell so many fucking tickets this year.
Correct.
You know, like the overall, like, and or people are not in this scenario, it's not even necessarily like judging the trend. It's more judging like the loudest parts of the fan base for the Mariners. Cause I think there is a reality that like so many people complain about the Mariners, and probably 90% of people are just fine, are just looking forward to watching baseball. But there is that 10% that is so loud and also so annoying about the Mariners spending. They're not wrong necessarily, but it's just like, got it. Point taken.
Right.
But for the Sounders, I was like, the overall fan base, it's just nowhere near as large as many of the other teams that we're talking about.
Yeah, without question. There's not people calling in to KJR on a regular basis, Seattle Sports complaining about the Sounders management. It's mostly limited to Twitter and Sounder and Blue Sky now and Sounder at Heart. All right, well, Seattle Reign FC opened the season Saturday with a home draw against Gotham FC. They equalized on their only shot on goal of the match through substitute Emery Adames, who came on a few minutes earlier. Couldn't take advantage of a Gotham red card in the 87th minute, just had a few minutes to play with the player advantage. Reign played this one without new star Lynn Biondolo, who's day-to-day with a lower leg injury, per manager Laura Harvey. We'll see whether Biondolo is able to make her debut. She missed out on a potential revenge game against Gotham FC, who traded her to the Sounders over the offseason. It's another of her former teams, North Carolina Courage, on Saturday as the Sounders head on the road. Could be both the Sounders in UW, or the Sounders, the Reign in
the
Reign, women's
the Sounders two times.
I did. It could be both the Reign and UW women's basketball playing in the state of North Carolina on Saturday. So
there
be
we go. I guess that'd be fun. We're probably the only podcast drawing a connection between those two things.
Probably so.
Or human beings. This is like the olden days. I got some Guinness 0.0 here. And
I had that a few weeks back. It's pretty solid. I did not do it specifically for St. Patrick's Day, though.
But it's like the olden days where you're talking about something in the rundown. I'm like, I could just leave for a second.
Go get another beer.
Those were the days.
UW softball lost 2 of 3 to the number eight Oregon Ducks in their first Big Ten series. Got pretty worried that the strong 14-game winning streak against lesser foes was not going to translate after they lost the opener of the series 9-0 on Friday. They then split a doubleheader on Sunday after Saturday's game was postponed by rain. So all in all, a credible outcome against a top 10 ranked team. Sophia Ramuno got the first win the lone win in relief is pinch hitter Charity Sebeyatsi got the winning hit in the bottom of the sixth. Stevie Hansen took her first UW loss in the only appearance of the series against her former team, giving up 5 runs in 5 1/3 innings. So Huskies this weekend stay at home. They will host Rutgers in the first visit by a new Big Ten rival as they ease their way into Big Ten play.
You see that they had Scheinerbach on the value menu?
I did see that, yes.
First off, what a random beer to be on there.
Yes.
Second off, tastes like summer.
Not as much so as Lone Star, but sadly, still not distributed in Seattle.
So I normally at this time period, like South by Southwest was a week early this year. I don't know how the schedule worked out, because usually it aligns with the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, there's just like an extra week in March this year, basically.
So many times, like the first weekend of the NCAA tournament, I've paid no attention. Or like kind of seen it sporadically and haven't really been watching. But being able to just be at home, and I wasn't at South by Southwest either, but like being able to just be at home and sit and have college basketball on all day, I'm like, two thumbs up to that, because it's something that I have not experienced that many times. But did you see the chatter around South by Southwest?
I did not, no.
Very, very bad marketing. Very bad. So last year, they had a partnership with like the U.S. military.
Yes.
Out.
Yes.
This year it happened again. The amount of this, according to Stereogum, is like the peak was 2,000 artists were there. This year they said that there were 1,000, and 35% of them were international, from artists who get like grants sometimes from their countries or whatever to come. So that's like, we're talking about such a small amount of even just American bands that are there versus any other time. So South By moved up by like 2 days when the music programming is happening, and they cut the last 2 days of music programming. I think it ends on the Thursday now, I want to say, maybe the Wednesday. And people basically took that as South By Southwest music is dead. It is gone.
So it's just a podcasting thing now?
I mean, those things have grown much faster than music has grown. And no offense to tech and film and podcasting, but a lot less concerned with many of the cultural elements of it. And weren't told specifically by the governor of Texas, don't come here. So there's a little bit of a difference to it, but like the music is still happening. It's just all happening at the same time. It's not like South By Southwest tech, South By Southwest film, South By Southwest music after. It's kind of like, it's all in a festival happening all at the same time. But people took this to mean that it's dead. And they're like, no, no, it's not dead. It's all happening at the same time. And unfortunately, once that dialogue starts, I'm kind of like, I feel like people saying that it's dead means that it's going to be dead, that South By Southwest music will be no more within the next like 2 to 3 years.
There are sometimes that perception is in fact reality. Well, should we talk about the perception and the reality of the UW Mets basketball season? How's that for a segue?
Beautiful. I think perception and reality are exactly the same.
Yeah, they're probably pretty close on this one. We didn't talk about it last week. Maybe we just mentioned the games. They lost to USC, lost to Oregon.
Did we?
I don't think so. I think I skipped it unintentionally. On senior day, they lost to Oregon in overtime, finished 4-16 in Big Ten play in Danny Sprinkle's first season. And like that in and of itself is not necessarily that concerning to me. What I did not feel great about was this quote from Danny Sprinkle after the game. When I took this job, I knew what I was taking. I knew what I was in for. I knew year one was going to be hard. There was only so many Big Ten level players that were going to be able to come to Seattle in April and May. You hit on some recruits and you miss on some recruits. We just needed more consistent play across the board.
You didn't like that quote?
I don't like that quote.
Tell me why.
Because it's like totally deflecting any blame here. And like, I don't think, first off, all coaching changes happen in April. This is not like Jed Fish, when he took over the UW football program, like that was unusually late. It was after the transfer window had primarily occurred because of the fact that the Huskies were busy playing in the national championship game. And they didn't have didn't have Nick Saban retire and didn't have Kalen DeBoer take over until after all of those things had happened.
Kalen
after
DeBoer didn't bother recruiting also while he's still here, but okay.
It's a dumb argument. After Kalen DeBoer had already recruited a 2024 roster. So that was an unusual situation. This is when coaching changes take place after the first weekend of the NCAA tournament. Like that's pretty par for the course. And another part that kind of bothered me, well, you know, someone who was a Big Ten quality player, as it turns out, who was available in April, Wesley Yates III, who is better probably as a redshirt freshman coming off an injury year in the year he spent at UW, was probably better than any UW player save Great Osabor this season. And frankly, even that one I think is kind of debatable. He averaged 14 points per game at USC. And look, that one, the decision was probably sealed when Quincy Pondexter was let go from the coaching staff and ended up at USC. And I don't think that you should necessarily decide to keep Quincy Pondexter as part of the coaching staff because of one player. But it's also the sort of thing like, don't tell me these guys weren't available in April when that guy who left your program was one of the better freshmen in the Big Ten this year. So I thought it was a significant amount of excuse making. And then the third thing is, and this, I think, is to your point that you kind of wanted to talk about. Like, the expectations were not high for this Husky program coming into the season. It was, you know, if you looked at the KenPom projections for teams in November, the Huskies were not one of the top 15 teams in the conference. I think they were 17th at the start of the year. So it wasn't necessarily surprising that they missed the tournament, but their KenPom ranking has still dropped 34 spots since the start of the season. This was a disappointing performance by any measure, I would say.
I like it. Roast him.
I mean, I'm not roasting him, but I just, again, I would like to see Danny Sprinkle say, "Hey, this one's on me. We weren't where we want to be this season. We're going to keep working to get it right."
Tell me what the deal is with Wesley Yates III. So he was committed to UW.
He's not committed. He was at UW all of last year. He didn't play due to injury.
Was injured last year.
Yeah, I mean, he
Spent the
was
last
a
season
big
there.
time recruit. We were very excited about him, but unable to play in the Mike Hopkins era.
And then Quincy, he was somebody who Quincy Pondexter probably presumably recruited.
Well, Quincy
Juban goes to.
Pondexter is related. I forget what the technical relation is. So,
Why then was do we know the mechanisms for Danny Sprinkle not bringing Juban back?
no, but I mean, I certainly grant him the right to choose his own coaching staff.
Fair enough. I it's so funny that that's your perspective, because for me it was kind of like what is the point that you said I was going to make?
Well, that I think that you thought that this season was a disappointment.
I guess so. Yes. I think I expected the team to be better than they were, and I was wrong.
Yeah.
I expected Great Osborne to be better than he was, and I was wrong about that. Great Osborne's not a Big Ten basketball player. He's
He's a Big Ten basketball player. He's
not
not a
a
Big Two Ten go-to star.
yes, he's not a he's a Big Ten basketball player, of course, but like he's not a star in the Big Ten. He's a little bit undersized. His skill set, his finishing just isn't the same. Like it's different than playing at Utah State.
I mean,
And
but the thing is, like, if you looked at the advanced stats as we did when Great Osborne transferred here, they suggested that the hype around him exceeded his actual production at Utah State. And now I'm not going to be that critical of Danny Sprinkle because, number one, it was his guy, and number two, again, Kentucky. I don't know what I can't remember what the full list of programs that were in on him was, but like a lot of other country co programs.
Oh no,
Believed in
it's
him too. By the way, that's another program. Mark Pope took the job the same time Danny Sprinkle did. It turned out Kentucky did not finish 4-16 in league play.
I feel like I'm kind of in the giving Danny Sprinkle an incomplete right now.
I mean, that's
And
obviously the right. I'm not saying that it's a like this is never going to happen, but I would say I was hoping it was going to look better than this in year one.
do
And
we
even if
think
they didn't necessarily have the players, particularly in the backcourt, that there was going to be more of a structure and you were going to see, well, this is how it's going to look when you improve the talent. And I don't know that I saw that this season.
I don't think there was any of it. I mean, yeah. It was kind of an oddly assembled team overall. I get it. When you're assembling a team full of transfers, it's a little bit difficult to put together a team exactly the way
But
you'd
that's
like
what
it
this
to.
is. That's what college basketball is. It's always going to be a team full of transfers. They do have, a strong recruiting class coming in. Nico Bandalo and GJ Mandaquit, two top recruits. So I think they will look to emphasize that more, I think, going forward. Whereas this year, Vazumana Diallo was the only incoming recruit who, factored into the rotation, really.
I will be fascinated to see what things look like next year, given those two things, and given we have no idea who's going to be on the team, right?
Of course.
There's going to be eight players that are not on our radar right now who are going to be on this Husky basketball team. So it's a really difficult thing to judge. And this offseason, what Danny Sprinkle is doing right now, there is groundwork that's laid earlier than just that time period of the when the transfer season happens. Or whatever. Like, I do think Danny Sprinkle will be more successful in, I want to call it the transfer market, because that's ultimately what it is, right?
Sure.
In the portal, the transfer market, I think he's going to be more successful in the transfer portal this year than he was last year. And I think he probably understands it's just some of the coaches who've been really good coaches who've moved up levels, like Danny Sprinkle has fairly quickly, have been pretty good pretty quickly, right?
I mean, Danny Sprinkle was at Utah State. I would be lying if I didn't say part of what's interesting to me is that Utah State has now just like rotated through all these different coaches and just been equally good the whole time. Or, they were really good under Ryan Odom, I guess, statistically, 2 years ago when they were 28th in KenPom. Although they only got a 10 seed, they were an 8 seed under Sprinkle, had been very good under Craig Smith, who then washed out at Utah where he got let go this year. And then this year, good again under Jared Calhoun. They're a 10 seed in this year's NCAA tournament. So, I don't know that that's necessarily like a knock against Danny Sprinkle, but the whole idea that, like, oh, he kept this team competitive after taking over as a new coach. Like, well, Jared Calhoun did the same thing this year.
When Ryan Odom also, right? Like he's He's in the NCAA tournament in year two at VCU, right?
Not T. Do you say TCU?
VCU.
Yeah, okay.
The
I mean,
I
by the way, Louisville was one of the other finalists for Great Osmore. I went and looked this up.
that's not the
Louisville's.
issue, is not that Great Osmore isn't a good
No, no,
player.
no, no,
It's
no.
that
But Louisville is like an NCAA tournament team after the year before the team that Pat Kelsey took over went 8-24, 3-17 in conference play. Like that's not what UW was. UW was in a better position than that.
Okay, so let's say that Danny Sprinkle, it is incomplete as far as what he will be long term.
Of course.
However, the window for Danny Sprinkle of where can he get to as a head coach, right, with this program, it probably shrunk after the season. Because if he was as good as some of those coaches were talking about, they would have been better this year, right? There would have been more that we would have seen from the structure of the offense, from coaching, et cetera. It would have seemed like the team got better. Like the team gave up at the end of the season. You know, like I don't like necessarily when people say that, but that's a reality. Those last handful of games, you know, what did they get obliterated by USC?
I
They
mean,
didn't start good and they didn't finish good.
I think the road games, yes, they got out of hand. Now, again, they did take Oregon, a number five seed, to overtime on senior day.
Okay, so they played a game. They played game. But like the two USC losses were very brutal to have both of those and probably shouldn't have lost either. And then especially with Wesley Yates the third on that team. Like I think the window, the ceiling, the floor has probably gotten a little bit lower at Danny Sprinkle, and the ceiling has shrunk right now.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
So it is still an incomplete, but I do think it's funny because he's always going to kind of, you're going to view him in opposition to Jed Fish. And like the Huskies ended that season, even though they lost the Husky football team, even though they lost their last game, like
Plus two.
the sky is the fucking limit for that team. Like we're looking at it as like they've got so much figured out right now, which it could go away in a season, but like in this moment, in this offseason for Husky football, there's so much reason for optimism because of how they ended last season. And for Husky basketball, it is the exact opposite. There's almost no reason for optimism aside from what the transfer portal will look like for the team. So, I
I
was
also,
more neutral on this. I think you were probably more negative about Danny Sprinkle because I was just like, it's a weird season. It's his first year. He gets another year to figure it out. If they're bad next year, then all of a sudden it's kind of like, I wouldn't be shocked if he was fired after year two. It would surprise me, but I wouldn't be shocked. If they repeat this year after year two, what are we doing? Right? Like, literally, it's not the type, you don't build programs in college basketball. If you can't figure it out in year two, you can't figure it out.
I would be shocked if it happened after next season.
Depends on how bad they are.
Although I guess, I mean, one of the funny things is, at the time,
Not as
this is
higher.
something we were giving credit to. Can you remember the name of the UW athletic director? I quizzed you on this in
No
the
idea.
UCLA Sports
No
Union.
idea.
Troy Dannon.
Troy Dannon, yes.
Troy Dannon laid the groundwork for this hire. Pat Chun came in at basically the same time, or maybe even a little afterwards. So this isn't Pat Chun's guy. It is interesting. I think Kyle Smith presumably would have taken the Stanford job either way, but if he knew that Pat
How is
Chun was
Stanford?
come, how is Stanford? A lot better than UW. I know that much. I don't think they made the tournament, but
But do
they.
you hear what I'm saying? That in this modern era, like if you're recruiting freshmen, you're building a program, you get a larger like runway than you do when it's every year the team is new. You gotta figure it out fast because if you can't figure it out by year two, something like that, then I don't necessarily believe that you will ever figure it out. Or maybe you will, but it would require such a long runway of losing that
I mean, I guess
you're just not gonna get it.
I would look at Tina Langley. I mean, there's a little less transfer activity on the women's side. So, that's maybe not a completely apples to
There's
apples
also
comparison where,
less
this,
angst on the women's side.
I mean, undoubtedly that's true, but and again, this is like largely a homegrown program. They have a, Delia Daniels is a transfer and then Tyra Ekay coming off the bench is a transfer, but like they went, I guess her second year was they went 19. Oh, her second year was the year that they went to the NIT final. So yeah, maybe pay no attention to me.
I mean, that's what has to happen, though.
I mean, I don't know that specifically has to happen
But
because the Big Ten
improvement
is
is
also,
what has to happen.
yes, I agree the big improvement has to happen. Stanford has won 21 games, which is their most, more than they won at any point in the Jared Hass era, although they are not nearly as well rated. They actually took advantage of the fact that they got to go to a way weaker basketball conference going to the
That's
ACC.
crazy.
Isn't
That is
that
wild.
bonkers? Oh, not a great year for ACC basketball.
The Big Ten is deep, though. You know, there's no elite team in the Big Ten, but it's a very deep league
Yes.
overall. And the Huskies were hurt by that. But they were also bad. How many games did they win in the end?
Over the course of the season,
In Big Ten play.
4-16.
They won four games.
And it's not even that they won four games, even though they did finish last in the Big Ten. It's how often they got blown out that was, I think, really troubling in the end. In conference play, they had a an efficiency margin of minus 17 per 100 possessions. So
I don't
that's
know what
not
Danny Sprinkle
ideal.
does. Does that make sense? What is he good at? What does he coach? Was the offense better? Was the defense better? Was the recruiting better? And
I
this
think
is.
the recruiting was better. I think this year's recruiting class is the best that UW has had in a period of time. Maybe back to the, I guess back to the Jaden McDaniels, Isaiah Stewart class would probably be the last time it's been this good.
You're talking about the incoming class.
Yeah.
I'm just so distrustful of recruiting rankings right now because you could mention a player that's later in these notes, but I'm just like, it's been a few years in a row that there have been like four-star players from the Northwest who all bear a pretty similar situation, and they are fucking awful.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, the Huskies, I mean, I guess Fazumani Diallo was McDonald's All-American last year,
That's
so
not who I'm talking about, is Zoom
yes,
Diallo.
I know that's not who you're talking about. Yeah, I don't know. It's an important couple of months here for Danny Sprinkle as they put together this roster. So far, even though the window is open to submit notifications of transfers, we've only seen it from one UW player thus far, that being guard Jace Butler, who was a consensus four-star recruit committed after Sprinkle took over, played just 192 minutes as a true freshman, wasn't particularly productive when he was on the court, shot 25% from the field, including 2 of 12 on two-pointers. So it'll be interesting to see, what kind of level he sort of ends up at. Although, one thing we have seen a lot over the years is 4 years, even 5 years now that so many players are getting that is a long time to develop. Who would have expected that Eric Stevenson would become an NBA player? And lo and behold, he is.
I guess I Christian King is he was only a three-star recruit. I thought Christian
Oh
King
no,
was.
Christian King was not considered a major
Who was
recruit.
the dude the previous year?
I'm not sure who you're thinking of.
Maybe
And
2 years ago, there's like a white guy from like Olympia.
oh, that was much longer ago. Jackson Grant. I mean, I
Yeah,
agree
Jackson
that
Grant.
the recruiting rankings for centers are often questionable because those guys just don't play a lot against a lot of players of similar size, except unless they're, in the kind of the high level AAU circuit. So yes, those recruiting rankings I would be very distrustful of. Guards, I think, are
At Utah State, scoring 1 point per game.
guards, I think they're usually more reliable, I would
I guess that
say.
was last year. Wait, so Danny Sprinkle
Yeah.
inherited Jackson Grant?
No, he recruited him.
Recruited Jackson Grant.
Yes. So Jackson Grant just not playing basketball last year? Yeah, it does seem like that. Did not play basketball this past season. So yeah. There you go. All right, let's wrap up with the Seahawks and Cooper Kupp.
You don't think Jackson Grant was playing like high level AAU?
I don't know if he played a. I don't know what his AAU situation is. I'm just, yeah. I don't know. I
He's a
don't know.
freaking McDonald's All-American.
There's sometimes you see players and you wonder exactly what the recruiting rankings were based on. So. All right, let's wrap up with the Seahawks bringing Cooper Kupp back to the state of Washington. Even though he did not grow up in Western Washington, he was in the Fresh Hop region of Yakima. We learned at his introductory press conference on Tuesday that his family was all Seahawks fans, and little loyalties divided, having to watch Cooper Kupp come to town as a member of the LA Rams for lo these many years, and now get to full on support him as a member of the Seahawks.
Yakima's not that far. Of course they were Seahawks fans.
I mean, it's not surprising, but also people like nationally might think that Yakima is like, you know, in the Seattle area, and it's not in the Seattle area. It's in the Seahawks territory.
It's not the 1980s when Cooper Kupp grew up. Like, the Seahawks had a huge fan base at that point.
Yes.
Like, they weren't going to be 49ers fans. Pretty much any person, here's what I'll say, any person raised in, I'm not even going to say the tri-state area, because I think Idaho gets a little bit questionable, but most people in Oregon, at least like halfway through Oregon, and Washington, who were born after the year 2000 or something, or after the year 1998.
But his dad was a Seahawks fan, so this predates Cooper Kupp.
But like, the fan base is large enough now that there's a bigger gravity to the Seahawks than maybe there was from people who are like 80s fans.
In case you were wondering, the Seahawks passed on Kupp twice in the 2017 draft when they traded down and took Malik McDowell at number 35 and then Ethan
wondering.
Posick at 58. Kupp went pick 79 to the Rams. But you know, where could the Seahawks have scouted him? It's not like Cooper Kupp had an enormous game in Seattle or anything. That didn't happen.
To give John Schneider credit, I don't.
Yes, there's a lot of players. Obviously, many, many teams passed on Cooper Kupp.
Exactly. Like, he was the 79th pick. Yes, the Seahawks passed him twice. Who knows? Malik McDowell. Like, it could have been a completely different career,
yes.
Obviously.
Ethan Posick, I don't know if it could have been that much different a career. Kupp peaked in 2021 when he was Offensive Player of the Year, nearly reached 2,000 yards, also led the NFL with 16 touchdowns before winning Super Bowl MVP after having 8 catches for 92 yards and 2 touchdowns against the Bengals, who Tristan thinks would have been like the 10th best team in the NFC that year. He had 6 touchdowns in 4 playoff games.
Best team in the AFC that year.
Had
Not
6
the
touchdowns.
10th best. But
in 4 playoff games that year, including, I believe, the game winner in Tampa Bay, but just hasn't been the same since that magical season. He's played 33 total games over the past 3 seasons, and his yards per target have declined quickly from 10.2 in 2021 to 8.3 in 2022, 7.8 in 2023, and then 7.1 last year. He's also seen his target share drop the last 2 seasons with Puka Nacua's emergence as a number one wide receiver.
So this is 2021, the 2021 season?
Yeah. Were you disputing that?
No, I'm just...
Does it seem longer ago or more recent?
No, the Bengals were 16th in DVOA.
Okay, fine.
And you don't want to put an asterisk next to the Super Bowl. Anyway.
Cooper Kupp. lots of other teams had the chance to beat the Bengals, too. And lots of other teams had the chance to beat the Rams, and none of them did. So, I think the number one thing, like, obviously we're excited to have Cooper Kupp and, you know, that element. Just how much he helps the Seahawks roster is a little bit more questionable, I think, than they might indicate based on the performance the last couple of years.
His career, honestly, like, looking at his stats overall.
The 2021 season, it really, he's a one-time Pro Bowler.
It is, I'm actually kind of surprised that the numbers aren't better over. I mean, he's only been over 1,000 yards 2 times, and then he just has this one season right in the middle with, like, freaking Jerry Rice-like numbers. I mean,
part of his injuries, he did, like, you know, have some much stronger seasons that the total wasn't that great because of, you know, he only played 8 games in 2018, his second year, when he averaged 10.3 yards per target. You know, kind of came on late as a starter, as a rookie. So, you know, some of those could have been bigger statistical seasons.
I just, in my head, I felt like he had probably like 5 years where he was well over 1,000 yards.
Yeah. I guess 2018, was it an ACL? He had a serious injury in 2018, then was a candidate for comeback player of the year the following year.
Which is also a great season, 2019. I mean, yes, it's an outlier. Cooper Kupp's a good football player.
Oh, wow. Did you realize he tore his ACL against the Seahawks? I did not know that.
I kind of remember that. It's a long time ago, but
All I remember is that Rashad Penny's ACL happened against the Rams. So.
the injuries have obviously been a factor. Cooper Kupp's a good football player, though. And
Wow, he had a monster game against the Seahawks last year. I'd forgotten that too. 11 catches, 104 yards, and 14 targets.
you know, we talked beforehand about how basically every signing that the Seahawks have taken this year is a swing, and this is obviously one of them. What is the get off number after 1 year?
We don't know. We don't know anything about the structure of this contract. It's
Okay,
just
so
been reported 3 years, 45 million. We don't even know the guarantee total. So
it's so
now that he's
strange.
officially been signed, we should get some details on that.
Okay, I mean that'll be fascinating to see. Like the expectation for the team has to be that they're able to get off this deal after a single year, which I'm sure will be the case for not an obscene amount of money.
Yeah.
They just needed another receiver right now. You know, like they're going to go into the draft. The only thing that makes me nervous about it is your argument that you think they're less likely to draft a receiver in the first or second round because of the Cooper Kupp signing. And I think that would probably be bad process. We'll see who's out there. We don't know going into it. This could still be part of the Seahawks being like, we are going to be set at every position before the draft.
I
But
mean,
that
I think
doesn't.
Marquez Valdes-Scantling fit that template more than Cooper Kupp to me. So to break down my argument that I've made to you offline, my argument is we're talking about an offensive coordinator in Clint Kubiak who uses multiple wide receivers less than basically any other offensive coordinator in the NFL. It's a lot of two wide receiver sets. So already in having, three proven NFL receivers, you've got a lot, I would say, for his system.
I
And then
guess.
the other element, I guess, is just the flip side. Still haven't done anything on the offensive line. It feels very likely that they're going to address the offensive line multiple times early. We'll
Yes,
see if they
but
feel
not in the
comfortable
first
doing it in the
round.
first round, but.
I just John Schneider, everything that he has told us, it's probably not going to happen in the first round. There are a lot of picks after that, though, to do it, to bring in competition on the line. The yards per target, it was down last year at 7.1. It was a down season overall for Cooper Kupp, but like, I think given the high-end ability that he has, I still think it makes sense overall as a signing. I do think this is probably the one that I'm most skeptical about of all of the transactions. Like, if you were to ask me about it, the risk is not as high because the money isn't as high, but like, I feel way better about Sam Darnold right now than I do about DeMarcus Lawrence or Cooper Kupp on the Seahawks. I like Cooper Kupp. But if you're talking about if they're going to use two wide receivers more often than anybody else, and it's going to be obviously JSN, are we factoring in that Cooper Kupp's just going to be injured, or in those three wide receiver sets, he'll be on the field, but it's going to be a really small workload? And then if that's the case, it's kind of like, why are we signing a player for this kind of money to have a smaller workload,
I
you
mean, I
know,
think he's
like
the number two guy. It's just that I think it's MVS whose role is smaller when the Seahawks are at full strength.
he has such a clear role as deep threat, Marquez Valdes-Scantling, you know, like, and Cooper Kupp doesn't necessarily have that.
I mean, look, if they get the version of Cooper Kupp that we've seen over the course of his entire Rams career, they're going to figure out a role for him.
Yes.
It was interesting, so. My colleague Seth Walder wrote about the fact that both of these play both Kupp and Jackson Smith and Jigba have been most comfortable in the slot.
Yes.
Kupp was aligned as a wide receiver 38% of the time, according to tracking last year, JSN 20% of the time. So Kupp downplayed those concerns, I think, at the introductory press conference, said, a lot of those in the Rams offense, it wasn't even a clear distinction between who was the slot receiver and who
Yes.
was the outside wide receiver. So, we'll see. I think the optimistic view is that Kupp can help JSN refine some of those, slot route running skills. Not that JSN needs a lot of
I was
help
gonna
at this
say, I think
point.
he's fine. I
He's
think he's fine overall.
and he had a pretty good guy to watch in Tyler Lockett for these past couple of years. This was the concerning stat that Seth Walder had in that piece. The ESPN has an open score based on tracking data. Cups was 76 in 2021, which is still surprisingly low. I guess a lot of contested catches in there. It dropped to 37 last year. So, it's not just that the ball wasn't coming his way with Puka Nacua. It's also that, he wasn't
He just
getting open.
wasn't open as much.
But I mean, I think the flip side of this is, and why do the Seahawks like him in this offense? Cooper Kupp is a terrific blocker. So you put him in a lot of those schemes, in the play action situations. That's where I think this is potentially a significant upgrade.
Okay.
So.
I just it makes me nervous if it's Marquez Valdes-Scantling is not on the field. I think we are maybe taking a little bit too much from Clint Kubiak's history as well. Like it may be how much he's going to use a fullback in this offense. I'm a little bit skeptical about that. And I do think that the offense may change and evolve over time. And again, like you were saying, if Cooper Kupp is able, if he is anywhere near what he was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they're going to find a spot for all these players. And you're going to be
Yeah, I think
rotating
that's
in a
probably true.
number of wide receivers.
And I think
But
Valdes-Scantling does project as more of a, situational receiver. Like he started for the Saints, but I don't think that's the ideal role for him.
no, I don't think so either. But I mean, if you're saying that they're starting two wide receivers, are the two wide receivers who are starting then JSN and Cooper Kupp
I think so, yes.
and MVS? I mean, but it's basically like
And it's
to
not like
me,
you rotate players through those positions. It's not like,
exactly.
MVS is never going to be on the field when there's only two wide receivers.
Yes. That's why I don't think this changes things as far as the draft pick goes. And
We'll see.
that would be my number one concern, because I do think that wide receiver, there are so many needs on the Seahawks. Like, that's not the only need. They're probably not going to draft a guard in the first round. It'll probably be whomever is available with that first round pick. Maybe they'll trade out of it completely, right? I feel like the Seahawks in the draft have drafted players in the wrong years, if that makes sense. That DK Metcalf, I think, was one that it was a good wide receiver draft, and they drafted a wide receiver. But the and I think Charles Cross was it was a good tackle draft, and they drafted Charles Cross.
I think
But
if you're looking for counter examples, D. Eskridge in a year where I don't know the wide receiver depth was as strong, or was there? Well, that was there was one wide receiver in particular in that second round, wasn't there? I
who
don't
was really
know.
good
I thought
right
that's the
after
look you were
Dieskridge?
giving me.
No, I can't remember. The times that the positions have been deep, it feels like the Seahawks haven't necessarily gone with the trend. And it seems like that's actually worked out a little bit. And this is ultimately around where the Seahawks are drafting, seemingly like a pretty good wide receiver draft in a year that best case scenario for Cooper Kupp, are there 2 years on the Seahawks? Like realistically, he's just not going to be on the team long term. So if you're passing on that because you have Cooper Kupp set, that is the place that it makes me nervous. I just don't think they're going to do it, though.
I agree. And I'm not saying like, oh, they definitely won't draft a wide receiver. Like,
But
first off, they don't know what they're going to draft.
a big piece of the value that you get from these players, like Cooper Kupp has to have value right away, given the
Yes.
contract, because the most likely outcome is that Cooper Kupp plays 1 year on the Seahawks. So he has to make that, he has to have value equal to that money that is being paid to him right away. And it's the same with a draft pick, right? First round draft pick, it's draft picks get paid more than anybody else. They kind of need to have value right away.
I don't
So,
agree with that wide receiver. I think you need to have value by year two. I don't think you need to as a rookie.
but you have to be able to get that player on the field. You know, JSN was on the field as a rookie. He wasn't as good as he was in his second season,
How much
but
was he on the field?
I think he was on the field quite a bit
I
as a
mean, he
rookie.
had. I guess he was targeted 93 times. That is quite a bit. He just wasn't down the field.
No, he was used horribly, but like him being there and being on the field is still helpful to get those reps. And that's the thing where it's kind of like maybe things get clogged, but then are they factoring in that Cooper Kupp? They can't count on him being healthy. It's funny, I saw somebody mention like Cooper Kupp is a Hall of Famer, and it's like not even close, right?
No, it does not seem likely.
Cooper Kupp has a Hall of Fame season. He has one of the better seasons for a wide receiver. And then a bunch of pretty nice years. But I'll be fascinated to see how much they're able to scheme him open as well in this offense. And it's going to be a different role. We just don't know the answer to all these things right now. But I do think having that depth and needing, you need four wide receivers who are able to play. Like we saw this last year for the Seahawks. You know, players miss time. DK Metcalf missed time. You have to have four capable wide receivers who are getting on the field. Maybe it's Jake Bobo who's the last one, but I kind of like it. It's a lot of money to be paying for depth for Cooper Kupp. But again, like we talked about, it's a bit of a swing. So
Nico Collins and Amon-Ra St. Brown were both drafted after D.S. Grinch in 2021, although it was fairly significantly after, and the second round was not a good time to take a wide receiver. There's a stretch here that is goes from Kadarius Toney at pick 20 to Amari Rodgers at pick 85, where not a lot of NFL success from that whole
Kadarius
group.
Kadarius Toney was drafted in the same year as Amon-Ra St. Brown.
So
I feel like Kadarius Toney's just like been through a whole career, and Amon-Ra St. Brown is still young.
Kadarius Toney's been through a lot. I agree. He is 26. So we did get some details on Sam Darnold's contract. Now that that one also is official, but we have not gotten the complete details, but we Pro Football Talk reported that only the $37.5 million in 2025 compensation for Darnold, so that's between his signing bonus and whatever his base salary is this season, is fully guaranteed at the time of signing. An additional $17.5 million of his 2026 base salary is guaranteed for injury, but not for if he's cut for skill reasons until the first week of the 2026 cap year. This is a pretty common structure for Seahawks contracts, as many of the beat writers pointed out, including Russell Wilson's contracts were also structured this way. You know, the Seahawks have not been one to give out like these fully guaranteed type of contracts. Now, what I noted on the Discord is what makes this difference is different is Russell Wilson's signing bonus was so large that it functionally served to guarantee his salaries in many of these years, because the Seahawks would have had to take an enormous cap hit to waive him. Sam Darnold's signing bonus will not be that large, so I think there will be the opportunity for the Seahawks to move on from him after this season, and assuming he's not injured, to save money in the 2025 cap or 2026 cap by waiving him. So this doesn't necessarily mean it will happen, but that there is that potential, I would say, for the Seahawks. And it does seem to indicate that the market for Sam Darnold as a starting quarterback from other teams just wasn't there.
It's kind of wild to me. I mean, again, to finish 10th in MVP voting, you really have to prove it in the NFL for many years in a row. And I think the Seahawks got a freaking steal on this. I'm pretty excited about Sam Darnold overall.
You're talking yourself into it more and more each week.
Oh, I mean, I was happy about it from the very beginning, but I think overall, like, the way it's funny that the Cooper Kupp signing, I feel like people have kind of let off the Seahawks because it's like, all right, they figured out the replacement for DK Metcalf, and it's a little bit like, I don't know about that.
The order of which moves people were excited about, I don't know that I totally agree with.
I've Seahawks almost talked myself out of Cooper Kupp even during this podcast, looking at some of the stats where it's like, I started being like, yes, Cooper Kupp. And now I'm like, huh, like DK Metcalf has multiple seasons that are just way better than Cooper Kupp.
And Kupp had some other really strong seasons that were shortened due to injury. So, you know, staying healthy is obviously going to be the biggest thing for him. That's not a thing that tends to get better when you're in your 30s.
I was going to say, like, if we're like, yeah, he had some great seasons that were cut short due to injury, and now he's 32.
All the
I
more
still
opportunity
like,
for that.
I like Cooper Kupp, though. And I think that's kind of the main thing, which is all the way back to college. You know,
oh, yeah.
Like,
I mean,
we
were more focused on Vernon Adams at the time than Cooper Kupp specifically.
Oh, Vernon Adams. He'll be a star someday.
What about Vernon Adams Jr. is up to these days? Is he still playing in the CFL? Probably not.
But I mean, DK is at like 9.4 yards per target the last couple of years. You know, like,
oh, he is still playing for the Calgary Stampeders. There you go.
There were a couple seasons where DK was over 1,000 yards for his in like the 7.4 range on the yards per target, which wasn't necessarily that much better. He obviously has no season that's anywhere close to the Cooper Kupp 2021 season. And so that's something that he is capable of. And I do think that playing opposite Puka Nacua, you know, your open rate, like Puka Nacua is rated the best wide receiver in the NFL. And I feel like Cooper Kupp had to have been helpful at that in some capacity. I just don't know about Cooper. Man, I think this might be a terrible signing.
I mean, we'll see what the contract is.
Either way, it's still going to be fairly good money in year one.
Yeah.
I feel like they're paying for an outlier season. It's so funny. This is more paying for an outlier season than Sam Darnold to me is paying for an outlier season. It's just the outlier season happened in 2021. Is that not true?
I mean, again, paying for the outlier season would actually be paying him like 50 million a year.
I guess so, but like we don't have the structure of the deal, but I get the feeling it's going to be pretty solid money if it's a 1 year contract.
I think it's all fake.
You think the whole thing is fake and it's like a $10 million deal? Like, what is the number for one season that you think makes sense for Cooper Kupp?
12 million.
I think that's fine. 1 year, 12 million. What it was reported as? 3 years?
345.
You think 1 year, 12 million is good? I agree with that. But people just kind of have it all wrong. Again, it's like the thing we talked about before. You just get an idea of a player in your head and they kind of sit there. Once people have made up their minds about a player and people made up their mind about Sam Darnold, it's like Sam Darnold's bad. Sam Darnold's a joke. And it's like Cooper Kupp, the most, like the times that we remember him the most is him winning the Super Bowl.
I mean, actually, it's not. It's all these games against
Or
Seattle.
playing against the Seahawks and being open every single possession. But also, he's playing against fucking Pete Carroll's defense. There are a lot of players, right?
Yes, a lot of players who are not worth 15 million a year.
I mean, there are a lot of elderly quarterbacks that, had they only played against Pete Carroll's defense, might have been pretty phenomenal. Our perception of them might have been pretty good.
Did you know that Vernon Adams Jr. was the quarterback for the BC Lions the
Oh,
last
there we
couple of
go.
seasons? He got traded to Calgary after
That's
last season.
our favorite Canadian football team.
It is. That's our team. It's the only one I've seen a home game of in person.
Have you? Okay.
Yeah, a bit of a BC Lions game. He led the CFL in passing yardage in 2023, and they made the Western Final that season. Not a great West final for him, but alas. So the Seahawks have hosted a number of guards, have yet to sign any of them. Presumably that's going to happen at some point. We'll see who they decide on. I will wait to have any position on these visits until they actually sign someone.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, just one season where he was, I guess he played every game in 2019 Cup, but it's missed a lot of time due to
The other
injury.
question, tying together multiple storylines from this podcast. When the Rams and Seahawks play next season, should we call it the Cooper Cup?
There we go.
On that note,
Thanks for listening.
thanks. The good news is they can hear all of them. We're watching this show, Apples Never Fall. It came out a long time ago. I think it came out last year on Peacock, I guess. And one of the plot lines is about a character recording a podcast, but they repeatedly just like people coming into the room is they're recording the podcast alone by themselves. And I'm like, they don't tell anyone beforehand they're starting to record. It's like, you know. Very rarely does that happen to us. Every once in a while, one of your 10 to 15 children will wander in. But you know, that makes more sense than
What got you to
adult
the
children.
place of watching this show? 47% on what is the Rotten Tomatoes? 48% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's a Peacock original starring the guy who is on The Office after everybody stopped liking The Office.
That's not how we refer to Jake Lacy.
Was he on The New Girl or something?
No, I mean, you should cite Obvious Child, of course. And I think
That
of
Jake
him.
Lacy. That was I saw somebody on the Discord who was like Spring Breakers first grade A24 movie, and I was like, hold on. And then it came out, Spring Breakers came out 2 years before Obvious Child. So
Okay.
I paused.
I'm glad you did the research before you got publicly angry. I endorse that as a strategy. I
Obvious Child
personally
is the first great A24 movie.
think of him is being from the series version of High Fidelity. where he plays basically the exact same character he plays
Does he
in
really?
Obvious Child.
This dude has really been around for a long time. He's
But
on every
also,
show after you start like stop liking it. The
well,
fourth and fifth seasons of Girls, where I'm like, I don't even know if I remember him on Girls.
White Lotus, he was
And then,
season one.
yes, he was in the first season of White Lotus before White Lotus got good.
And I would
No,
say that
not actually.
no. I mean, I would agree that White Lotus has
He's
peaked so far in season two.
Jake Lacey is replacement level accurate.
Oh, this is offensive. I wanted the series to be more centered around Jake Lacey and Alison Brie. I enjoying their interactions.
Is that why you're watching this other show? Because they're both on the sh I have literally, like, sometimes you hear about a TV show and you're like, oh yeah, I've heard of that. Apples never fall, not once.
I had not heard of it before we began watching it, I'm afraid.
I mean, it's not, I like also that you described it as old because it came out a year ago.
Well, I'm just saying it's not freshly out of the oven right now.
What's your review of it?
It's very watchable.
That's all right. I've defended the movie The Electric State to no one. No one's ever asked, but in my head, every second that I've watched it, I've been like two thumbs up. Do you know about this movie?
I don't.
It's like Netflix all-time bomb.
Oh, really?
Well, I don't know how to describe it because I don't think it's a bomb because I think Netflix is fine with it. But it stars Millie Bobby Brown and Chris Pratt. Can you imagine a time where all like given where we started with Chris Pratt, that I would find Chris Pratt to be just like a very, very like fine in the movie, but really annoying as a person. That was just like not on the list of things. I feel like we got milkshake ducked by Chris Pratt, but
No, I would not say that. I think we got overexposed to Chris Pratt. But I would never say anything negative about any actor with ties to the Seattle area or who's a Seahawks
any
fan.
actor, so be careful what
Well, okay,
you're
yes.
saying.
I mean,
I feel like
I'm not saying that. You
I'm gonna look
understand
up
what I
some
mean.
political views of Jim
Oh,
Caviezel here. Just hold
no.
on. Jim
Whoops.
Caviezel comes up way more often than he should on this podcast.
Does he? Shouldn't he come up a lot? He went to Kennedy. He's not
Shouldn't
exactly like
I like your argument
an
isn't that we
obscure
don't talk
person.
about Jim Caviezel that much. Your argument is that we shouldn't be talking about Jim Caviezel a lot.
Caviezel was basically in our backyard. I
Since
don't know what the
2021,
timeline is.
Caviezel has repeatedly
Okay. No,
publicly
we're
endorsed
cutting it
elements of
off.
so funny. Okay, anyway, the TV show
But this
Severance.
cast is great. Brian
Sam Neill?
Cox, Stanley
Oh, and
Tucci,
the Electric State.
yeah,
It
Lee
had a
Harrelson.
15% on Rotten Tomatoes.
It
But
doesn't always
like
work. Ki-hai Kwan,
honestly, like if it the worst insult, I think like critics were trying to shit on it
Giancarlo Esposito, yeah,
and
like
to,
Jenny
like
Slate.
critics
Wow,
were
speaking of Obvious Child.
there you go. She's great in it. I was like, who's the voice of that robot? And I was like, no, Jenny Slate. Cheers to you. Critics were trying to basically like they wanted to, everybody was dunking on it, right? It was
Yeah.
like Airplane, like right after he taught them basketball, And by dunking on it so hard from the critics, I was like, I have to watch this movie. Ignoring would have been worse. That's the thing. This Paul Anka's guarantee always works. Just don't look. If you want something to go away, just don't look.
I agree. That's why we don't discuss Jim Caviezel on the podcast.
Probably better. I'm not trying to discuss him. The entire world was doing that with the apples. Apples never fall. I had to, you told me a second ago and I already forgot about it. It also is just a horrible name. Like, but Severance, the creator of Severance, is from Olympia, Washington.
Wait, I thought Ben Stiller. I guess he just does he just direct it?
Ben Stiller? He's like it's under his production company.
I see. Okay.
And Ben Stiller has directed many episodes, but he's not like the creator.
Oh, there you go. The more you learn. Olympia, Washington. Went to Western. Nice.
He went to Western and then I believe
Why
NYU.
isn't he the listener?
He's also the exact same age. I was at a children's basketball party earlier, and I met a person, and they were like, "Oh, are you from around here?" And I was like, "No, I'm from like just south of Seattle." And they were like, "Where?" And I was like, "Okay, you're in the know." And I was like, "Boulevard Park." And they were like, "Hell yeah, we know about Boulevard Park," which does not. And I was like, "I have like a 1 in 20 chance. I don't want to say 1 in 100, but like 1 in 20 chance when talking to a person, even from the Seattle area, that they know what Boulevard Park is." He graduated Evergreen High School 2002,
There
1 year
you
older than
go.
me.
There you go.
He was deep in it. He was like,
Did
"Oh
you
yeah."
pitch the
I don't think I've pitched the podcast to a single person in my entire life.
like that you have
Ever.
the
I don't want to say ever, but I'm
like
always
the
the amount of people who know that I host a podcast that I know in the real world is a small fraction. I'm embarrassed by us.
To think that you're the person here should be embarrassed by us.
People really liked us listening. We were re-listening to last week's episode, as we have done once of times. And when I said
With
I
your
was like
family.
talking about the Celebrity Jeopardy thing, and I was like, if there's a category for very minor celebrity, and Kayleen was like, "Oh, that's cold," and I was like, "I didn't think that. I thought it was just like a norm. That's like a normal PeltonCast joke."
I would, yeah, I mean, I would definitely say that about myself.
Yeah, and I was like, "Do you think that Al's on Mina Kimes level?"
I'm not like walking around thinking I'm like an important person.
Even I felt like it was actually a compliment to
I
call you a
agree.
very minor celebrity. The
I
word was in
concur.
there. Welcome back to episode 15 of Apples Never Fall. Wait, no. Oh, wait. What's the name of the podcast? Episode 15 of Apples Do Fall, an Apples Never Fall recap podcast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
We'd actually call the podcast Apples Never Fall, Never Fails.
Apples Never Fall, Never Fails. Is it only one season?
Yes.
We're on the re-rewatch.